North of Summer. This is an article that appeared in the Beaver magazine for summer 1966. Arctic Poems and Prose. In the night of July the 10th, I watched southern darkness change to 24 hours of northern light. I'd read about this 24 hours of daylight business before, but to actually be there, at the geographical point when darkness is left behind, and there's nothing but light in the sky ahead. That's a different thing than having it described on paper. It gave me a strange feeling. About 5 a.m. we came down through gray overcast to a land of dark hills streaked with snow, ice rimming every shoreline, from bathtub-sized lakes to the wide expanse of Frobisher Bay itself, Baffin Island. As a child in the 1920s, I'd looked at an old library book containing pictures of roly-poly, slant-eyed Eskimo children, red-mouthed polar bears, whales in a country Jonah never dreamed of, Baffin Island. I remembered those pictures ever since. And suddenly, 40 years later, there I was in Baffin Island myself, with an exuberance and elation I felt only a few times before, like coming back from Cuba in the summer of 1964, landing at Windsor Airport to go through customs, walking along a white corridor with other passengers and suddenly thinking, why, I'm home. This is Canada. I wrote a poem both times. At 5 a.m., the Montreal passengers stumbled from the plane at Frobisher Bay, with smudged, grouchy faces averted from the smudged, grouchy sky. An extrovert sailor who had been airsick and miserable on the trip north. He was to work in the meteorological division of the Department of Transport. A brown and leathery Yorkshire engineer, bound for a construction job. A couple of civilian weathermen for DOT at Frobisher. A Swedish writer-photographer team. They planned to write a book about the Northwest Passage today. Tori and Jan always had a good bottle of scotch in their pack, which endeared them to me for some reason. And others, 13 in all. The turning point. Over northern Canada, daylight ahead and growing. Behind only darkness at 2:30 in the morning, while the DC-4's engines drone. Suzanne, the stewardess, is a French-Canadian agnostic, which surprises me a little. Then she says most of her friends feel the same way about God, and points where the last darkness lingers, the moon's silver image and the silver aircraft. But I see angels out there sometimes. Human angels, I say. She laughs and talks about going back to U of M to get her M.A., and I must have said the wrong thing. The full shape of the Arctic moves under us, and flows into quiet islands and tilted coastlines, the world's axis turning and turning like a planet inside your hand. Then it's lost in white mist. The sun and moon change places, but we find the world again a few minutes later, with snow-streaked hills down there that must be Baffin Island. A club-shaped word, a land most unlike Cathay in paradise. But a place the birds return to, a name I've remembered since childhood in the first books I read. A warm kind of wonder in myself now, I used to be ashamed of. It's getting cold as hell here. I guess the Arctic is no place for shirt sleeves. The stewardess serves coffee before we land, looks out the window absent-mindedly. What's your thesis, Suzanne? Baffin Island is huge. Nearly 1,000 miles long, and almost four times the area of England. Frobisher Bay is a kind of modern frontier town of 1,800 people, government administrative center of the District of Franklin. Air passengers stayed at the Federal Building, a sprawling complex of offices, warehouses, workshops, etc., sold to the Canadian government by the American Air Force, a legacy of the last war. I got a room with Tori and John and went straight to bed. At noon, the three of us went sightseeing with the Northern Affairs Regional Administrator, Mr. McKee, and wound up going fishing. Mr. McKee's wife was traveling south 2 days later, and he wasn't in a good mood, but catching an Arctic char cheered him up a little. In case anyone doesn't know, Arctic char is salmon cum trout, the most delicious fish this side of Isaac Walton's fry pan. I stayed at Frobisher 4 impatient days, awaiting the plane north to Pangnirtung, mostly wandering around with Tori and Jan. But after 2 days, they flew north to join an icebreaker on its southern voyage. I was sad to see them leave. All the friends you meet going to and from and hither and yon seem to vanish just like that, gone forever. They one way and you another. But I hope they write their book back home in Sweden, and that their prose and color photography of the North taste like good Scotch whiskey to the readers. I hope it sells many copies. The fifth day, I hitched a ride north with a chartered Canso amphibian to Pangnirtung. It roared and wallowed and rattled through the air, above glittering lakes and muskeg, high over the tremendous ice-flecked blue of Cumberland Sound. Cumberland Sound? One of the two twin arms of the sea that makes Baffin Island on the map look like a giant toasting fork pointed at the rest of the world. We splashed to a water landing at Pangnirtung Fjord. Wayne Morrison, the regional administrator, took off passengers and mail in an open boat. A motorized tractor beast fumbled passengers and baggage over tidal stones to land. Pangnirtung was more like it, the true north strong and ice-choked. Smiling native peoples from my childhood picture book become flesh and blood absolutely. And since I was there to write poems, I started to write them. I'd sleep till noon in the iron bunk at the hostel, wander over all the settlement of 200 whites. Eskimos and whites in afternoon and evening, and write most of the night. And there was no night to speak of. I stayed at Pang 10 days, going to 50-cent movies with the Eskimos, mostly shoot-'em-up westerns, buying groceries at HBC, watching hunters bring in their furs to the manager, going with a Department of Public Works guy from Ottawa, looking for suitable gravel to mix into concrete, which we found in an old river delta at Pang, and just wandering. After 10 days, the DNA people made arrangements for me to go with an Eskimo family in their boat to the Kikistan Islands where they lived. And that was really the chance I'd been waiting for, to live among the Eskimos without English-speaking people around, and find out their own terms of existence. The heavily loaded Eskimo canoe left the HBC dock in late afternoon. I took along a 2-week supply of groceries, a sack of flour for Jonasi and his wife, Regalie, my portable typewriter, plenty of warm clothing. The Eskimo family had their own supplies, gasoline for the outboard, naphtha for stoves, food, etc., and of course, the 2 kids. It was cold in that boat. Not colder than 35 or 40 degrees, but wind in the open water of Pangnirtung Fjord made it seem much colder. I huddled down in the bow, with parka pulled over my head, and the limitations of being a soft, middle-aged white man brought home to me forcibly. And tall, overhanging cliffs we passed under were a strong reminder of how dependent I was on Jonasi, the Eskimo hunter, who spoke only 6 or 7 words of English. Not that I worried much. Though when you're jerked directly from modern cities to a hunting culture, it makes you realize how important environment can be. No restaurants or groceries, just dark cliffs and the onward stretching sea. From the settlement at Pang to the fjord mouth is about 15 miles. We chugged along at a fairly good clip, moving steadily through growlers and small icebergs on the way. At one point, I noticed a small rocky island on which there looked to be at least 50 stranded dogs. They rushed howling and whining to the shoreline when we passed. I'm told that's an Eskimo habit, to leave their dogs on an island for the summer months, and there's no sled hauling work to be done. The islands they're on look like stone icebergs, steep and dangerous-looking hills of rock attacking the air. You'd think the dogs would starve to death, but apparently they don't. At 8 p.m., our small expedition landed on another rocky island, similar to those where the dogs were marooned. And since Wayne Morrison had told me the Kikistan group contained a small Eskimo village, I expected to find a substantial settlement on landing, winter houses in the works. As it turned out, there were only a dozen or so Eskimos, plus dogs. The only dwellings were transient tents. It was like getting off a train expecting to be in Montreal. but actually finding yourself in Caughnawaga instead. Jonasy and his wife had a spare tent in their duffel, with a rip in one end. Regally sewed the rip with a hand sewing machine on the stone beach. Then we hauled and tugged it into the air, with rocks to anchor the skirts. I blew up my air mattress, spread out a sack of dried lichen to make a box spring, and turned a cardboard grocery box upside down as an executive's desk for my portable typewriter, and then I was in business. When supplies in the tent had taken on the accustomed disorder that accompanies me, whether home or abroad, I set out to explore the little island, still trying to match it up in my mind with a Kikistan group. But it didn't look the way it was supposed to. For instance, how could the Eskimos live in those air-conditioned tents all winter? The water supply was a deep hole among boulders, to which you had to lower a tin can on a long piece of cord. It would freeze solid the first cold winter night. How then? No use puzzling about it. I couldn't ask any questions. Jonasy knew only the aforementioned few English words, though he seemed to recognize other words when he heard them. Besides, there was nothing to be done, even if I had landed in the wrong island. I was stuck for 2 weeks, wherever I might be located. Leave all such worries to Jonasy. A small brown man in a blue nylon parka, a decorative red fringe at the waist, grinning at me, reassuringly, now and then as if he thought I needed it. I had to leave it to Jonasy. The island was a mile long, and less than half that distance wide. Brown Precambrian rock piled into a 100-foot hill at one end, a small clearing at the other, where the Eskimos were encamped. A couple of hundred yards away, across blue water, another island, with dogs climbing around the crags like savage goats. Guns boomed every few minutes, and a short whispering silence, while echoes built up in a crescendo, bouncing off the sides of other rocky islands. Like being at the center of a seashell, menaced by your own magnified heartbeat. On the high rocks, overlooking blue water between islands, Jonasy and a couple of other hunters lounged and smoked, rifles leaning nearby, but keeping a sharp lookout always for seal, despite the seeming negligence. Below, on the stone beach, piles of rancid yellow blubber, detached and grisly seal flippers, tin cans, dung, broken toys, cracked and broken phonograph records, garbage of all kinds. In the cold Arctic climate, decay must be a matter of weeks and months instead of days. And floating in shallow water at high tide, the 15-foot carcass of a white whale, blood drifting smokily away from its slashed and ghostly face. Guns boomed away on the other islands around us. Impossible to say exactly where the sounds came from, but I think they must have been louder where I heard them than at the source, the echoes building into a real Beethoven finale. Eskimo children scampered around playing hunting games, and other games whose rules remain secret. Dogs sidled away from me, suspicious and savage if I approached them. A weird ow, ow, ow sound drifted through the night-long twilight. A sound so empty of meaning or previous association that it dragged my spirits down like lead. Unlike the loon or any bird I have heard before. I found out later it was the cry of old squaw ducks. Birds with names like that can't be very terrifying. Jonasy came to my tent for tea before I crawled under the sleeping bag. The Mounties had given me maps of the southern area of Baffin. I got them out for him to locate our present location. Pointing at the Kikistan Islands group, I looked at Jonasy, raising my eyebrows inquiringly. He shook his head and grinned. Now we were getting somewhere. Well, where are we then? The Eskimo hunter pointed to another small group of islands, further north. Brown's Harbor? But it can't be Brown's Harbor. It was, though. Jonasy's brown finger remained stubbornly on Brown's Harbor, as if he knew I didn't like the civilized, unromantic sound of the name. And there we were. He shrugged and grinned. Going to sleep later, huddled far down in my old sleeping bag with those damn ducks going ow, 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 I decided it really didn't sound very civilized after all. Even with a phonograph nearby grinding out, "You are my sunshine," I couldn't mistake the place for Toronto or Montreal. And thinking of the animal carcasses and dead white whale on the beach, I renamed it mentally Slaughter Beach, which is not to be found on any of the government maps. A place of death and empty loneliness, an island born long ago when mountains were coming to birth. Next day I felt better. The sun was shining, and weather almost warm. In mid-afternoon we broke camp, leaving Slaughter Beach for the Kikistan Islands. I wrote this next poem along the way and later. It's a part serious, part fantasy piece. Maybe it means what you want it to mean. I was more or less happy on that trip, riding through the vivid blue sea, threading between occasional icy rubble with its glowing internal off-turquoise shade, the long stems of kelp swimming up from seal towns below. And like all journeys, it gave me the feeling of being suspended between two parts of life, waiting for the real world to begin again. Odysseus in Kikistan. Cruising through the summer seas with Slaughter Beach behind us and the Kikistan Islands ahead, while ice castles go drifting by in the dark blue water. Jonasy steers for the islands, and I soak up reflected sun, with 3 days' beard and a hangover from drinking so much hot tea, and being hospitable if it chokes me. Though I hate the damn stuff. Seamany makes summon the Coleman, speeding along in another boat, and Jonasy steers close to get hot tea for himself and his family. I make a face and refuse mine, while everybody laughs. And for some sad reason, I'm happy, lounging lazily on the gunwales, sort of creative doing nothing that I make especially of. Ice castles drift by in the sunlight, blue and turquoise magic, molded and shaped by water. One looks like a bowling alley, another like Maple Leaf Gardens. Here's a dinosaur's white skeleton, the landing field for DC-4s, and a seagoing hamburger with relish from Joe's place at Frobisher. You'll send your change by dolphin. A king-sized diamond from Tiffany's no lady will finally wear. And you almost expect a sign, castles for sale. Apply at Circe's Island. They come equipped with obsolete plumbing and Franklin's ghost behind the stairs. But the most delicate dripping music, mermaids dreaming of being human, an all-girl orchestra's tinkling flutes, on Jonas's Mediterranean cruises, maybe. What do you say, Odysseus? What do you say? If sirens sing on the Arctic Islands, they come equipped with a pair of flippers, blubber lips for drinking tea. They sport a set of real false whiskers and a cold, cold bed on the floor of the sea. They're shy of strangers, and their singing teacher never taught them to hit high C. But the castles? Well, that's different. I'll take them over apartments any day. I'll take them over apartments any day to look at, not live in, and have one moved to Côte de Neige, our white high-riser at King and Bay. But we haul our freight to Kikistan Harbor, north of the tree line, south of the pole. The Lord Mayor, dressed in his best new parka, comes down to the beach with a big hello. 6 white whales dance through a seaweed arbor, and several thousand cordial dogs, plus an Eskimo official greeter. It must be whole home week, by God, and a guy with a CBC loudspeaker who wants me to say a few words, but not unless I happen to be John Diefenbaker, which is rather confusing, so I explain that I'm only Odysseus, after all. Only Odysseus, after all. Well, I join the Eskimo Stevedores Union. We pack our luggage up from the sea. Now I'm hard at work on a new translation of Homer's Odyssey, Arctic fashion. Jonasy invites me over for tea, and that's what happened. On the islands, I set up shop in the same old tent. Portable typewriter and a cardboard grocery box. Coleman stove in one corner. A jumbled heap of clothing and groceries in the other. There were only 2 Eskimo families on this particular island, but I'd given up trying to make the real world match the one in my head. There were only two Eskimo families on our particular island. just made mental adjustments to the actual, keeping my preconceptions to a minimum. Only two families, but around the camp area several winter houses, apparently abandoned not long since. And I wouldn't have been surprised to wake up one morning and find them occupied again, the people having just returned from founding a colony in Carthage or Antarctica. It became a habit of the two Eskimo wives, Regali and Leah, to visit my tent every day and drink tea. In sheer desperation at being unable to speak their language, I read them poems, talked about anything that came into my head, chattered away like a compulsive idiot. In cases like this, I'm sure some communication always takes place beyond the ordinary senses. One guesses and feels other people's emotions, anticipates reactions, noticing thoughts come swimming into the contour of a face and the inclination of a head. And once I had the bright idea of a sing-along, Eskimos being addicted to country music. So we sang songs in both English and Eskimo at once, until I ran out of things I knew. And certainly it was an odd feeling to listen to Burns' Auld Lang Syne in Eskimo, though I liked that song in any language. They sat on my air mattress, drinking literally gallons of sugared tea. Excuse me. They sat in my air mattress, drinking literally gallons of sugared tea, the two babies on their back being fed at frequent intervals, not from bottles either. That tent must have seemed a combination music hall and nursery. I wrote poems about everything, going hunting with Jonasi, Eskimo wash day, stone tent rings, and one about the return of Jonasi and Simony from a 3 weeks, my mistake, and one about the return of Jonasi and Simony from a 3 day hunting trip I was glad I hadn't taken. Me in an open boat for 3 days? Besides, I don't like hunting. Not since I shot a squirrel with a .22 years ago and watched the dish rag of fur wriggle slowly into death. Besides, I'm too lazy. In the hunting poem, I wanted to describe what happened when the two Eskimos came back without exaggeration and precisely as possible. Again, I come to the sensed things of intuition, of which there may be little physical showing. I mean here the idea in the poem of a married couple being apart 3 days, their lives taking two different directions, each acquiring and living experiences temporarily unknown to the other. On return, the initial strangeness between them, even after that short a time, then the gradual reuniting of the two streams of experience. Two hunters, winding among the white growlers and turquoise chessmen in the harbor, landing among stones with the tide receding. Two hunters, 3 days gone for a boatload of seal and char, $70 worth of skins at HBC. The dogs and children come to watch them. The two wives stand 100 yards away, in separate doorways, and myself a kind of witness, but not exactly a reporter. Kabluna the white man, memorizing details outside my tent, with old squaw ducks going ow, 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 beyond the islands. On the stone beach, Jonasi strips the hide from a pair of seals, and throws their lard white bodies into the water, for dogs to eat in the bloody shallows. The two hunters turn with seeming negligence to the place where their wives are waiting, standing without expression in separate doorways. The hunters speak a word or two to their wives in the soft monosyllables Eskimos use, as if something flowed under the words, which weren't really very important, to Leah and Regali, the waiting women. I say hi to both the hunters, and then I'm silent, feeling the continuity of their lives, almost broken by distance, sort out essentials of what happened in each other's absence, and join again. Dogs on the beach are fighting and eating and roiling the water, bloody water. One of them yelps away from the battle, defeated. In each doorway, the hunters stand with their wives, as garbage rots slowly. The children play games. Icy chessmen in the harbor rock toward shore. A muscle of wind leaps from the sky and wastes itself against blue water, simultaneously observed by husbands and wives, with the white man part of their background, as the strings draw together again. After a while, they go inside, On the beach, dogs are still fighting over the bones and shreds of seal meat. A red pool, 10 feet across in the water, is a death area, slowly widening, slowly turning blue. And beyond these islands, other adjustments are being made. Time passed quickly. At night, the weird ow, ow, ow of ducks, and strong rain beating at the tent, wind inflating and deflating my canvas heart. Sea sound swelled to a low roar that my ears mislocated, and seemed to come from right over my head. Dogs congregated around the tent, fought major wars and minor battles, whined and cried like people. At intervals, the dogs all howled together, beginning with a tentative, wavering tremolo, rapidly swelling into Tama Bedlam song of an Arctic madhouse. I'd wake in the night, thinking they were trying to get into the tent. The sound of running, circling footsteps, thudding against the canvas, breaking two guy ropes on one occasion, urinating over the entrance flaps. I didn't appreciate it. I saw the dark dog bodies inside the white canvas. I'd scream and howl with calculated rage in an effort to discourage them, and couldn't. I think they must have loved me. If it wasn't dogs, there'd be an ear-splitting roar in the night to take their place. I thought of polar bears. It wasn't polar bears. They thought too much of their skins to hang around Jonasy, or the last trump. But it wasn't the last trump. There could have been celestial clubs pounding. The racket was caused by huge chunks of ice left stranded after the outgoing tide, splitting thunderously apart by reason of their water support being withdrawn. But I got used to it. And sitting in that cold tent in the Kikistan Islands, I began to realize that all the books I'd read about the Arctic prior to going there amounted to a mere collection of statistics. Like staying in a small room, reading newspapers and encyclopedias to discover the nature of the world outside. You have to be there, see the color of things, the look of land and people, and throw away the preconceptions. The Arctic does not seem to me, as many books and articles describe it, a strange, barren, alien place, unfriendly to man. That's a cliché used by writers who read other writers and can't think for themselves. Like any other region of the world, the Arctic is not just one thing. It's a great many. The colors are there if you look, and the friendliness is there if you know how to find it. But you have to look for yourself. As Margaret Avison has said, nobody stuffs the world in at your eyes. The optic heart must venture. At the end of 2 weeks, Jonasy and I went back to Pangnirtung, Leah and Regali standing among the stone dolmens on the beach to wave goodbye. After I'd paid him at HBC in Pang, we shook hands, and he went off on his own concerns. Perhaps the language barrier and separate enclosed worlds of Eskimo and white forbid any other outcome. For 2 weeks, our lives had interlocked to some extent, just as the time spent with my two Swedish journalists had partially meshed with my own time. I remember Tori's whitish blonde hair. He's standing on a rock by the Sylvia Grinnell River, waving a bottle of scotch and grinning. I remember Jonasy, the Eskimo hunter, riding out to sea on a hunting trip, wearing a soil-white terralene shirt, while I shivered inside a heavy parka. And I think of many people like that. One typical look or gesture identifies their memory, which is really all that's left of a brief friendship, though perhaps a little sadness. August was drawing to an end. I had promises to keep in the south and waited for a plane. I'd stagger down to the beach, burdened with a load of duffel, only to find the plane overloaded already, and stagger back to the hostel and wait for another yellow bird. One evening I was returning from the RCMP office. The sun had just dipped under the horizon, leaving a broad gold bar stretched from headland to headland across the mouth of Pangnirtung Fjord. I stood in the mud and watched it for a few minutes with a feeling of sadness that I was going. What do the birds think? Are they exiles here from the rest of the world? Deja vu past egg and atom? From the yellow Sahara Ocean, or farmlands in Ontario, a witness hanging daubed in the rural blue. Well, a plowman half a mile down in the dark field with a snoring tractor moves in circular sleep. are exiles from the apple country, where macks and spies plop soft on wet ground in slow autumn days, the rotten, tangy odor of cider rising on moon-wept nights. Have they lists and a summary of things elsewhere? Remember the crimson racket, encountering tropic strangers, or nests of an old absence, lined with a downy part of themselves, far south. And being south, do they think sometimes of the rain and mists of Baffin, and long migrations wingtip to wingtip, a mile high, and mate to mate in the lift and tremble of windy muscles pushing them where? And do they ever, an arrow leader pointing the way, touch wearily down on ships passing, rest here a while and go on? Forgotten in the hurry of their streaming generations, another captain called Noah, Bjarne Herjolfsson, in horned helmet, and the sweep's silver lifting to alluring Hyperborean ocean, or whaling ships myopic stumbling from dull wave to dull wave, and the paint of the bright over the horizon gazing woman flaked with salt. How are we kept here? By what bonds are we always exiles? A chirping roar in the silence of foxes, and watery romp of walrus, and the long sea lambs, or perched on rubbery muskeg, like blue teacups, or lost brown mittens. By what agency of restlessness in the driftwood heart? Until on a day the eggs hatch, and the young are trained to endurance, ice rattles the shroud of summer, the flight plans sent, the logbook sent.